It was wonderful that Eugene brought the whole issue up about having to pray. I think we should. So I want to kind of watch the clock. So I'm turning with you this evening to our 11th Psalm. We're quite close now, coming almost to the 15, all of the 15 Psalms here. So tonight we're here in the 11th. Of the 15 Song of Ascents. Okay? Though this will take us to Psalm 130. Alright? So we've been talking in each of these Psalms on the whole journey of our own spiritual alignment. So this is our lesson. This is their actual practice. So long ago for the Jewish people, for God's people, as they marched towards Jerusalem with each of those hymns that they sung from Psalm 120 to Psalm 134, if not mistaken. Is it 134? No, sorry. Yeah, there you are. To Psalm 134. Now, in what kind of a sequence do they sing it? I don't know, because this was done so long ago by the children of Israel. But I suppose that they are quite a communal, in fact, they are a communal people. So families will travel together with their neighbors. So as they head towards, just imagine if they are traveling all the way from, let's say, from Jericho, all the way, all right, up to Jerusalem, or perhaps from Tyre, or from Sidon, you know, or from the Lebanon part of northern part of Israel. They travel all the way to Jerusalem, quite a long journey, and those days, of course, is by donkeys, all right, and they walk, and it's perilous journey, are difficult, not just the weather, the terrain, they're open to bandits, robbers, and accidents can happen, bullock carts can break down, animals can die on humans, and their journey can be jeopardized. So there's a lot of these experiences. So how do they sing all of these 15 Psalms? I don't know. I like to think that every time when they are journeying, there's someone who is leading them and having to sing each of these Psalms, each of all of the 15 Psalms together. So by the time when they reach Jerusalem, they would have sung all of those Psalms, I suppose. And so for our part and for our application, as I have been going through with you, is to read the Psalm. Read all of them, one by one. And we're reading tonight in the 11th of the 15 Psalms. And this, of course, is in Psalm 130. Each one is wonderful. Each one carries with it the lessons, the principles, the characteristics of which the Lord wants us to understand that our journey, our walk to God is also a lifetime, listen, a lifetime of a relationship with Him that demands that we make adjustments, that demands that we have to come to alignment in every part, in every way. However, that God is going to align us to put us back into line, into relationship with Him. Because once, when God brings us into a relationship with Him, He demands that we fall in line. We are kept in that one line with Him. We're kept in obedience. We're kept in submission. We're kept in the place where God can govern us. When God can establish His government over our lives. He wants to govern us. He wants to manage us. And part of the government and the management that God wants to put over our lives is to change our life, is to conform us into the image of Jesus Christ. And that's why we're saved. We're not saved so that we can enjoy our little world and our little dreams and our little, you know, fancy dreams that we have, or our little word that we want for ourselves. Our salvation is unto God. We were not saved so that we can be what we want to be. We are saved so that God can bring us to Himself. Salvation is unto God. And God is committed to that salvation that he was involved in when he sent his son to die on the cross. So God cannot depart from the nature of his salvation. God cannot depart from the message of salvation, because God himself is the very person in the message. A lot of us seems to think that the gospel is a message. It is a message, but remember that in that message is a person who brought the message, who announced the message. And his son is the messenger, is the person. And the person who announced the message is the message himself. So for you and I to receive the message is to receive a person. For you and I to believe in a message is to become like the person. Got the point there? Because you cannot divide the message from the person. That's why today the problem in the church is we want the message, we like the message, we're tinkled with the message, we're excited with the message. But the message comes with the person who brought the message. And that's why God is committed to bring you a message, but at the same time that in bringing the message to you, you will receive the person. You don't just believe in the message, you believe in the person. You don't receive a message, you receive a person. That's why when you receive the gospel, you receive a person. You become another. That's what the gospel is all about. You become another. So many of us, we believe in the gospel, but we're still the same. We sit in and out of the church for years. We're still the same. We read the Bible. We're still the same. We go to church. We're still the same. We're involved in church activity. We're still the same. We're not another. And the very fact that we're not another in itself shows us and tells us something is wrong with our believing. Something has gone jammed up. Something got jammed up in the process of your believing. Something is not right. Something has gone misaligned. Something isn't working. So the whole process of God aligning us fundamentally has to do with this. And so each of the psalms that we've been going through together gives us different aspect of truth, of reality, that tells us what that adjustment looks like, what that alignment looks like. And so there's so much of the wisdom that is embedded in these psalms, written so long ago, but yet there's such relevance for our time, for our faith, for the faith of the Son of God in our lives. So this is no different. This is no exception. Psalm 130, I like Psalm 130, I've always liked 130, is because it's very intimate, it's very personal, and it's very private. So here you are, let's read it, all right? Let me read it out to you. There are 8 verses in Psalm 130. It said, out of the depths I have cried to you. Now always remember, every time when you hear the word depth in the Old Testament, let me acclimatize you to thinking. Remember we were talking about perspective last Tuesday? It's one of the things that you have to learn is that the longer you are a child of God, the more perspective you must have. That's why many of us here, we need to change our thinking. That's why the Bible was given to us. It's so that we will have a biblical mindset. There are many Christians here today who may have an experience of God in their heart, but their minds have not changed. So our concept must change. Our mindset must change. Remember, when the Bible talks about depths, all right? Now, this is a word in which the world don't use. Secular education don't teach you that. University, colleges, and schools don't teach you that. But the Bible teaches that. Every time when God uses the word depth, what he means is this. He means that something of a chaos, something of an upheaval is going to come. Because death is something that we don't welcome. Death is something that we don't talk about. But in God's vocabulary, from God's perspective, death means, listen, is a time of chaos and a time of upheaval. Why? Why does God choose chaos and upheaval? Because that's the only way He can reach your depth. It's the only way He can reach something inside you. How many of you know that we all have depth? How many of you know that we are not just a belly full of dal curry and mihun curry and chao kway teow? Huh? When I talk about depth, I'm not talking about your stomach. I'm not talking about your intestine. I'm not talking your digestive system. I'm talking about your spirit. I'm talking about the person, the real person that you are. What makes you, what defines you, what makes you tick, as we say in English. What's inside you? And it's what's inside you that's important. What's inside you that's important? It's not what's outside. It's what's inside that determines who you are, where you're going, what you'll become, what your destiny will be. And so God is a God that is interested in looking at your depth. We don't like our depths. We don't like our insight. That's why we don't have the courage to face what's inside. We have the courage to look at ourselves in the mirror, but we don't have the courage to look at ourselves on the inside. And sometimes the only way God can get you to look at yourself on your inside is to bring chaos into your life, is to bring upheaval into your life, is to stir your nest, as we say, is to disturb your internal organs, spiritual organ, is to rattle your cage, as we say in English, is to rattle the cage, is to shake you up, is to get you into a discomfort, into something that you're not comfortable with. Because when you are in that state, that's where you start to find out what's inside. So depth in the Bible is always a connotation, is always a reference to chaos and upheaval. If you're not certain, you're not even sure of that, read Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. When God began creating the creation again, or recreating the creation again, what do you find? What was the state of the face of the earth? The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep. And what was happening? And the entire world was what? In the place of what? Darkness. Chaos. There was darkness. There was nothing. There was no light. There was darkness. There was chaos. There was confusion. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. So even when God began with creation, He began with what? With chaos. He began with upheaval. He began with darkness. He began with uncertainty. Out of the depths, I have cried to you, O Lord. Hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. If you, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But there is forgiveness with you, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord. My soul does wait, and in His word do I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman for the morning. Indeed, more than the watchman for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord there is steadfast love, or there is loving kindness. And with Him is abundant redemption, and He will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. It's a wonderful psalm, isn't it? Now, let me kind of put this and pack it this evening for understanding before we get into praying. There's a word that you must get familiarized here. This is true history. Now, there's a word that Christianity, in all the many hundred years of Christian experience, this word has been formed. If you're not used to it, now learn it for the first time, is this word called centering. Right? Centering simply means, it comes from the word center. And simply means this, we're talking about spiritual alignment. Spiritual alignment simply means, as what I've just said earlier, is God bringing us once again to the very center of God. Because the center of our life is God. God is our center. In all of this universe, in all of this world, what is the center of life? What is the center of the world? The center of the world is not White House. The center of the world is not material blessing. The center of the world is not education, is not fortune, is not richness, is not success. The center of the world is not beauty. The center of the world is not how clever you are, how smart you are, how handsome, how pretty you are. The center of the world is not your riches or your gains. The center of the world is not your recognitions and your popularity. The center of the world is not anything. The center of everything, the center of the world is God Himself. So, when God brings salvation into your life, when God brings Jesus into our life, the one goal that God is going to perform or has already performed in you is to center your life. Now, this is going to be a process because most of us, even though we are Christian, we're in many areas of our life, we're not centered yet. Give you a good example, our minds. Many of us here, our minds are still not centered in God. That's why we have problems in our minds. That's why our minds are not stable. Our minds are not healed. Our minds are not refined. Our minds are not renewed. Our minds are not changed. Our minds still have problems. Our minds still have bondages and blockages. Our minds sometimes don't function as we should. Because your mind affects your behavior. Your mind affects so many things that you are and that you are as a person. All right? That's why sometimes we say, why is this person, I've been telling this person 500 times, why is he still like this? So sometimes we say, oh, that guy has got a mental block. Well, unblock it. I wish we had, you know, instrument that we can just, you know, pull out the long instrument and just touch the guy's brain and then whatever has been blocked is unblocked. I wish that can happen. It doesn't happen that way. Because so much of what is in our minds need changing. It can be even in your character. It can even be in your desire. So many of the areas of our life need centering. All right? Needs to return to the center. So the process of God bringing us into the center that is in God is known as centering. Now, this psalm here, Psalm 130, has a tremendous lesson, has a wonderful display of what I call centering. So you notice that the arrow that I use here is one single arrow. All right, that's what centering is. He doesn't want us to get off course. Once we get off course, we get into what is known as decentering. We are decentered. And once you are decentered, then there's a problem in our centering. There's a problem in our alignment with Him. So far, so clear? All right, so God wants us to be centered. So I like the word here called centering. I want to use this here. All right? Wow. think again. Let what I just said kind of settle into your mind a little bit. Got it so far? So centering is God bringing us into the center. When God becomes the center in us, when God becomes the holding center, that's where He will start to what? He'll start to establish the control. That's why God starts to control your mind. That's exactly what the new covenant is all about. What is the new covenant? God is going to write His law into your mind. He's going to write His law into your heart. That's new covenant. It's no longer you trying to obey God, you trying to love God, you trying to follow God. God has taken over. God can write now His word into your heart. He can write His word into your mind. And when God writes His word into your heart, what happens? You become. You don't try to become. You become. You become what He writes into you. All right? So centering is this whole process, is this whole method that the Lord does in all of our lives. All right? Now, you notice this. I said to you that last Tuesday when we read Psalm 129, the prayer of the psalmist in Psalm 129 is, what was that? Enemies. Yes or no? Enemies from the outside is attacking. Enemies on the outside is being hostile to me. Enemy on the outside is harming me. Enemy on the outside is persecuting me. In Psalm 130, the enemy is not outside anymore. The enemy is inside of you. Who is that enemy? Sin. Yes, the enemies on the outside may attack you. The enemy who is hostile to God, who doesn't like God, don't like you either. The enemy that is against God is going to be against the church too. Jesus said, if they persecute me, they persecute you. That's what I said when I said that Christian must learn how to live centered in God and not in government. Whether it's UMNO or Barisan Nasional, whether it's PKR, PKH, or whatever peace. Our center is in God. You understand? There's only one God. There is only one center in the world. Every other thing is not a center. The government is not the center. The nation is not the center. God is. And when a man and a woman is centered in God, other things are going to attack the center. Anything that doesn't like the center will attack the center. They will attack God. The best form of government will attack God. Look at the government in America. It's anti-God. It's no God. Every systems of the world today is anti-God. I don't care whether it's the best of the systems in the world. They are against God. They are alien to God. They are the enemies of God. So Jesus said that if you love me, they will hate you. If you follow me, they don't like you. Because if they persecute me, why shouldn't they persecute you? If you say that you're following Jesus, they should persecute you. So the sign that a man truly is a follower of God is this. He will be persecuted. He will be misunderstood. He will be misjudged. He will be mistreated. He will be persecuted. He will be thrown at. He will be attacked. He will have hostility turned towards him. And that's the normal thing. That's why the early church will call to suffering. That's why Peter said that when you suffer, don't think that this is a strange thing. Don't think that, oh, what happened? Peter said, why do you act like that? And when you do suffer, rejoice. Now, what Peter is saying is, you don't go around, you know, laughing like a hyena. What he's saying is that why are you surprised when you've been attacked and when you're suffering? He said, that's not a strange thing. That's normal. Because he who has called you into this gospel, it's your privilege to now suffer for his sake.
So very important now. Now Psalm 129 talks about the enemies that comes from the outside attacking the church or attacking the believers and the children of God. Psalm 130 is not the enemies on the outside. It's enemies on the what? On the inside. That's why verse 3, if you, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? It's iniquities. When God begins to center your life, when the process of centering comes into a man, God begins to uncover iniquity. God begins to find out the frailty that is in a man, the sin that is in a man. Now listen, it's very important. Please see this. This is sin. This is no longer sin when you're outside of God. This is sin when you are now inside of God. When there is sin outside of God, there is no hope. When there is sin on the inside of God, there is hope. That's why it's for Christian to understand that for the rest of your days on earth, sin is going to follow. Sin is going to be a real thing in your life. I'm not saying that you and I should go and sin even after we are in God. But since you are in God, it doesn't mean that you are sinlessly perfect. It doesn't mean that there will be no more sin in your life, that you have no more problem with sin anymore. No. Meaning is, in fact, because you are in God and He is centering you to Himself, you're going to discover the frailty, the weakness, the sinfulness, the iniquity that is in you. And this is going to be a lifelong process. It's going to be a lifelong relationship. That's why some of you who are in center, or even though one day you will not be in the center, understand this. That's why temptation is a lesson that you have to learn how to overcome more and more. It's not just in the center that you do well. When you come out of the center, how you live, how you overcome temptation, to the point that one day you cannot even be tempted anymore in that one area. Whatever your weakness is to come to a place in your centering where that area of your life cannot be tempted anymore. What's that thing in you? Whatever that thing may be, it is to come to a point where God has so centered you in Him that that area of your life cannot be tempted anymore. It used to fall very easily. It used to give in to sin and iniquity very easily. But after such a process and the working of God in your life by centering you before Him, you are not even, you cannot even be tempted anymore in that area. I'm not saying that you cannot be tempted at all. What I'm saying is that particular area cannot be tempted anymore. It can come to you. It can attack you. It can open doors for you. And it can come like a barrage of attack over you. But you have come to a place where it doesn't affect you anymore. You cannot be tempted anymore in that area. And that's when you know that Jesus has risen. Jesus has become triumphant in that area of your life. All right? So here the psalmist begin to discover that this is not just enemies on the outside, but the enemies that is on the inside of me. All right? Tremendous here. Now, there are some very important words that I want you to find here. Now, that we just read a while ago. I'm going to just put them on either side, all right, of the centering here. One is hope. One is wait. You find that? Yes or no? Because in the whole process of God centering us before Him, it's important that these are the prayers, and this is what was sung out or what was written by the psalmist. Now let's put our eyes on it, shall we? It's a wonderful thing here. He says that I wait. I wait for the Lord. My soul does wait, verse 5. And in his word do I hope. My soul waits for the Lord. All right? Now, let me put this here for you here. It's important. Hope and wait. Because there is hope, that's why we can wait. What is hope? The hope. Now, hope is important. Hope is not people like us sitting in our house looking out the window and hope tomorrow it won't rain. That's not hope. What is hope? Hope is just what we just sang a while ago. Hope simply means I'm standing on the promises of God. All right? Hope simply means what? That God has promised something. What is it that God has promised? What is the basis of hope? His word. Right? His word is the very basis, the foundation of my hope. And God will never come against his word. God will never turn on his own word. God will never break his promises of that which he has promised in his word. So Christian hope simply means that your life is built on the very promise of God. That's why our hope is certain. Why is our hope certain? Because the word of God is certain. Why is our hope sure to be fulfilled? Because the word of God cannot lie. Hope is when you know that the promise of God has come to you. That's why our life. Remember what I said? Today, as Christian, we don't enter the land of promise anymore because we're not like the children of Israel. We don't have a land of promise or enter the land of promise. What we have as Christian today is what? We have a land full of promises. We're not going to the land of promise. We're going to what? A land full of promises. So for Christian today, our privilege, far more than Jewish children, the times of old, is that we have promises. Jesus has brought to us promises. There's so many promises that he promised us as God's people. So our life is built on his promises that God cannot break, that God cannot lie. That's our hope. All right? So when there is hope like this, then you can what? Read this, please. Then you can wait. What's the use of waiting when there is no hope? Huh? Let's say if I ask Bernard, when are you going to get married? And then he said, I'm waiting. Now, if he say he's waiting, then I'm going to ask him, where's your girlfriend? No girlfriend. Then who are you waiting for? So if there's no hope, then why do you wait? You only wait because there is hope. And that's why a Christian, that's why a child of God, in the process of God centering him into the presence of God, is to bring hope to him. That's why on a daily basis, one of the joy of your Christian life is to be reminded of the promises, to be quickened by the promises, to be infused by the promises, to be encouraged by the promises. You need that. That's why one of the most joyous thing to be with another Christian is a Christian full of promises. You know who is a Christian that is full of joy? When he's full of promises. A joyless Christian is a Christian that has no promise. Not that God hasn't promised you, it's just that you have not paid attention. You have not paid attention to a centering life in God. So part of the experience of God centering us in him is to bring hope to us. And when there is hope, then our waiting has meaning. Our waiting has strength. Our waiting is not tiresome. It's not weary. It's not feet dragging. It's not full of negativism. It's not all this very, morose and I don't know, come, come,
God, God lah,
Ken, Ken lah.
You know, the kind of, all kind of this low-level, downcasted, despondent talk. You look at most Christians today. I don't know. When it happens, it happens. When it comes, it comes. You know, the kind of attitude. It can get into that. And when that kind of a tone is heard, then you know that there is a lack of hope. And so when hope fails, then what? Then waiting has got a problem. That's when your days become very long. One day looks like 1 week. See that now? 1 month in the program looked like 5 years in the program. Wait becomes anguish. Wait becomes long, drag out. Waiting becomes a long shadow. When this is going to end, I can't take it no more. That's why the comparison or the image, the picture that the psalmist gives to us is this. He says, that's why my waiting is what? Is being compared to what? Come on. What's the waiting compared with? Huh? There you are. What does watchman do? In the days of old, a watchman always wait for what? Watchman's work is to watch so that in the night, when everything is dark, what? Enemies can show up, thieves can show up. All right, and that's when you need to be really in the place of diligence and watchfulness, and it's always dangerous in the dark. So a watchman's hope and wait is always every other time is that dawn will come, because when light comes, that's wonderful. Because when light comes, then you're able to see. All right, in distant place or in distant and far distant, you're able to gauge whether the enemies are out there camp and ready to attack the city. So light comes, when morning comes, that's the most wonderful thing that a watchman looks for. So this is the picture that the psalmist uses here. He said that my hoping and my waiting is for what? It's for the morning. For the morning to dawn. Some of us here, we wait and wait. Where's the morning? So this is God's comfort for our life. He gives us the morning. Suddenly, it breaks. Suddenly, the clarity. Suddenly, the provision. Suddenly, God begins to break in and invade and intervene into that affair. How he does it, we don't know. But what happens is that it's built on hope. I said, so see how important this is? That this is a very important ingredient to the whole process of centering. Now, this is given to us in verse 5 onwards. I'm kind of going back, kind of going forward first, now going backward a little bit, all right? 5, 6, 7, and 8. And that's why the psalmist begin to encourage not just himself now, so his prayer goes beyond himself, it goes to the nation of Israel. Verse 7 and 8 has got what is known as the projection. He says, O Israel, hope in the Lord. For with the Lord there is loving kindness, and with him is abundant redemption. He will redeem Israel from all iniquity. Now I want to kind of go backward a little bit here to the whole process of centering. Will you listen? Then this is going to make sense once we understand this here. I'm taking you back to verse 1 to verse 4. How shall I put this for you here? Now one of the things that we have, Christian, have not understood is this. Salvation is not just God removing sin out of your life. Salvation is not just God removing sin out of your life. That's important. That's fundamental. That's foundational. God removes sin. God breaks the power of sin in our lives. All right? He breaks the power, as John Wesley, in one of the famous hymns that is in our hymnal, he breaks the power of cancel sin, because God canceled out sin on the cross. And that which God has canceled out, when it comes to us, when Jesus enters into our life, there is a power that breaks, that cancels sin. Don't have to talk about that anymore. That sin is not God's problem anymore. God has broken it on that cross. God breaks the power of cancel sin. Now that's important. But God hasn't saved us just to remove sin from our lives. He has also saved us. Let me just finish this part here. He has also saved us to remove what? Me. I. Myself. All right? Let me put this again. Salvation is not just God removing sin out of us. Salvation is also God removing, read it, me out of myself. So, listen. So when we talk about centering, when God saves us, right here at the beginning, when God begins that salvation and enter into our lives through the person of Jesus Christ, the process is this, or the working is this. That's why Paul talks so much about the working. The working. The working that is in me. The working that is so powerful in me. The working that is so effectual in me. If you read all of Paul's letter, Paul is very certain. Paul is very committed to the process of working. That's why Paul saw that when Jesus entered into his life, it's like God putting him into school. It's schooling him. That's why the writings of Paul is actually the writing of a student. He has been schooled. He has been put into a school. You know, when you go to school, you learn things, isn't it? Huh? So when God puts you into the school of his son, what has he put you into? He put all of us into the school of Jesus Christ. Why must he put us in the school of Jesus Christ? Remember what I said earlier? That you cannot just believe in the message and yet not receive the person. Because the person and the message is one. Oh, that's a wonderful message. I believe in the message of Jesus. You not only believe in the message of Jesus, you receive the person of Jesus. You don't just receive a message called gospel message, called good news message that you heard from wherever you went. You receive the person that is in the message, because it is the person that is really the message. So when God puts the person of Jesus into you, he school you in Jesus Christ. And once you are in a school called Jesus Christ, then you start to learn who? Come on. You learn who? You learn Christ. That's when Paul, one time writing to the church in Ephesus, he reminded the Ephesian Christian, he said, have you not learned Christ? Now, he didn't put the word of. Did you learn anything of Christ? No, he didn't use the word of. Have you not learned Christ in your life? Because Christ is now your life. Have you not learned him? How does it look like when a man learned Christ? He begins to understand. It's not just that when God saved him, he stopped sinning. The more he goes on with Christ in this school, he begins to learn that there is so much in him that God has to remove. Jesus didn't come just to save me so that I don't have to sin. I don't have to take drugs. I don't have to take LSD. I don't have to take, ecstasy pills.
It's not just that. He saved me is so that he wants to what? Take me out of myself. Take the I out of me. So that the life of Jesus will replace my life. That is called the centering. That's why you notice the first four verses of Psalm 130. Now, this is the reason why it begins so wonderfully here. Out of the depths I have cried to you, O Lord. You see, that this psalmist is made to see, out of my depths, I've now finally said, God, I want you. Out of the depths of my heart, out of the depths, I have cried to you. Why must God want us to cry from our depths? Why must God reach our depths? It's so that when you are in your depths, you begin to understand, God, I can't do it. I don't want this no more. I'm completely useless. I'm completely with no hope. God, I can't. I trusted myself. I wanted this for myself. I thought this is the best for myself. I found out that God, when you took me into this depth, this failure, this terrible thing, whatever that may be, maybe a crisis, maybe a home, maybe a situation in your life, maybe anything that will make you feel that you are emptied out, you're bottomed out. You know, as we say in English, there's a word that says, he's out of his depths. You know, we say that, he's out of his depths. Meaning, you can't. It's just beyond you. This thing is beyond you. There's no power in yourself to overcome this, to go through this crisis, to step over this problem. You can't manage. And that's when you cried out from your depths. God, I cried from our depths. You see, this is wonderful because when the psalmist was crying like that, at the end of the psalm, he cried out for Israel. He said, oh Israel, hope in God. You know why? Because this one psalmist is telling the whole nation, because one day you will be going through this as a nation. It's not just my cry. One day it will be the cry of a nation. It's a national cry. They build walls today. Look at the crisis in Israel today. Palestine. They have no water. They have no proper food. They have no proper education. They have nothing. They have no weapons. They have no jets. They have no missiles. They have no nothing. But you know what? Israel, to this very day, don't know what to do with them. Can't conquer them, can't win them, can't do anything. They remain a thorn in the flesh to modern Israel to this very day. Why? Because God is the one who is doing this. Hey? They have nothing. The Palestinians have nothing. So, you know what? A nation like Israel, who is so strong, just recently the World Bank have named Israel, the 26th, the number 26th richest nation on the earth. They just started to build the economy only in the 80s. When they became a nation in 1948, 1948 is close to 50, 60, 70. For the first 30 years, Israel has no money. It was like any other nation, underdeveloped. But suddenly in the 80s, in the 90s, the digital, the handphones, the GPS came into the world, and the Jews became smart in all of this. In less than 35 years, they've become the 26th richest nation in the earth. The most armed nation in the whole of the Middle East. And they can't deal with those riffraff Palestinians. Why? Because God is using all of this, the lowest of the lowest, to deal with the richest of the richest. The poorest of the poorest to deal with the sufficiency and the pride of a nation. That's why, listen, the fall of Israel in the coming days is going to be through a people like that. It is going to nudge them and nibble them until they collapse. Why? Because God's going to bring them into a depth. The way God's going to reach depths is to reach through some of the most bizarre, most out of this world You would have thought, isn't it, for Israel to overcome Palestinian, it's like what? It's like a child's play. It's just A, B, C. No problem. They couldn't. They tried everything on the Palestinians. Oh, they can kill, they can bomb them, they can do this, they can start war on them. They know how to survive, they know how to dig holes, they know how to just lift up the existence. Why must God do that? Listen. It's because God has a way of reaching our depths. It's to show to you that even in your power, in your riches, in your cleverness, in all your supremacy, in your weaponry, in all of your greatness, you know what? You can't. You can't, because He wants you to be centered in Him. And we don't want the center. That's the problem today. We don't want the center. We still have self-trust in us. So God began the process of driving things into your depths, of reaching you in a place where finally you come to an end of all of your self-ability, all of your adequacy, all of your self-trust, all of your own ability. He empty you out. So far, so clear. You know why so many of us are not seeing the hope? Without the hope, we cannot what? You know why so many of us are not seeing the hope? Let me tell you this, guys. There's something about self-centeredness that blinds you from hope. There's something about self. There's something about this self-centeredness that has this blinding effect that doesn't allow you to have hope. See, guys, if you and I are trusting in ourselves, can we hope in God? If you are trusting in yourself, can you hope in God? You can't. It's the opposite. If you trust in yourself, can you hope in God? You can't. When is it that you finally can truly hope in God? When do you finally see His word has become so real, so personal, so full of promises in your life, when there is no more what? When there is no more self-trust. There's no more I, me, myself. When that is removed, when God removed this in the process of the centering, hope comes alive. When hope comes alive, the waiting is quickened, like a watchman waiting for the sun to rise on the horizon. Isn't that wonderful? That's why it's so personal in the prayer. You know, they call Psalm 130. There's seven penitent psalms in all of the 150 psalms. There are 150 psalms in the book of Psalms. And there are only seven penitent psalms. You know what is penitent psalm? That means it's a psalm for repentance. There are seven penitent psalms. Psalm 130 is one of the seven penitent psalms. Alright? And it's rightly put here. Let me read to you the remaining first part of Psalm 130. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplication. These are very personal prayer, isn't it? That's what happened, saints. That's what happened, brothers and sisters, when God begins to empty you out, not just remove sin, but empty you out from your depths. That's why it becomes so personal. God, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive. Then finally you know that God has ears. Huh? Then finally you know that God has a pair of ears. No, of course it's not like your ears. I'm not talking about the literal ear. Then you know that God hears. What it means here is that finally it becomes so intimate, so close to you that you even know in the process of you learning in the school year, God, you hear me. God, you hear me.
You don't need someone to come and assure you, hey, brother, pray. God hear your prayer. You don't need that anymore because you know in your heart that God hears you. That's what happens when God removes self out of you, removes self-trust out of you. There's an assurance that has come into you. God hears you because you know that God has ears.
And to the voice of my supplication, if you, Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand?
You start to realize now it's personal. God, you found me out. You found my iniquity. You found my shortcomings. You found my nonsense. You pinpointed areas of my life, and no one needs to know. But you know why? I know that God, if you were to number my iniquity, if you were to number them, I'm dead. And God, I know you know it. I don't need to tell the closest person in my life, God, you know it.
You know it. You know it. It's in me. And it's this consciousness, this presence of God that is in the psalmist here that makes him realize that, God, what can I hide from you? What is it that you don't know? What is it that is in me that you don't see, that you don't know? And if you were to mark me for every iniquity in my life, then who could stand?
This is truly a man living in repentance. This is truly a man who has been so schooled in Jesus Christ that saints, you don't need to, this man doesn't need to be judged by another man on the outside. He himself already knows he has been judged by God. You know, sometimes some of us, we find it so hard for another brother to tell us things about ourselves. You become so animated, we become so irritated, we become so upset, isn't it? Well, the reason why we can be upset by what someone said about us is because we have not discovered what God has said to us about ourselves yet. Because when you and I have allowed God to tell us who we are, you have no problem allowing another brother telling you who you are. The reason why we take it so personal, we're offended by what another brother or another sister tell us who we are, is only because we have not allowed God to tell us who we are in Him. And that's why we take it so personal. We're offended. We're offended by a brother or a sister telling us about our behavior in the kitchen, in the room, or sharing the bathroom, or using your toothpaste, or your shoes, or your clothing, the way you hang it. We take it so personal by one comment, by one correction that we receive from another brother. It's only because we have not allowed God to go deep in us. Salvation is not just God removing our sin. It's God removing us, me, out of myself. And so his understanding in verse 4, but there is forgiveness with you, that you may be feared. How do you know that this person is forgiven? It is God that he wants. Forgiveness is so expensive. Forgiveness is so moral. Forgiveness is so sacred. We treat forgiveness very cheaply today. Forgive me, forgive me, forgive me, please forgive me. And it's all gone. And tomorrow, next week, we're back to square one. We're back to what we are before. The psalmist here understood, but there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared. Listen, let me say something here to you. You know, I can forgive you. For instance, I can forgive Bernard. Human to human level, I can forgive Bernard. Let's say Bernard did something, he came up to me and said, you know, Pastor won't forgive me, I'll forgive you. In that level, you know, it's not a problem. But let's now understand something here. But with God, his forgiveness is different in the way we use it among ourselves. You see, when God forgives you, he intends to do something in you. That's why for God, forgiveness is a sacred thing. When he forgives you, he's not going to let you go away. He who forgives you demands that in the end,
you who is being forgiven will start to look like the one who forgives you. Can you understand that? That's why for human to human today, in our human level, forgiveness can become very cheap. Can become sometimes almost just a sneeze. Sometimes it could be just nothing. It just vaporizes. But for God to forgive you is for God to demand that His forgiveness over your life is to ensure that you will begin to become like Him who forgave you. That is what the cross was all about. The cross was God forgiving all of us. But he doesn't stop there. If he stopped there, you and I would have ran out there today and do what we want. We would have ran out today to do the things we are and to become the kind of man and the woman we want to. Why couldn't we do that? That should be the end of the story. But that's not the end of the story. For God to forgive you on that cross is to make you and I look like who? Look like the one that is hanging on the cross. And that to you and I is the bigger deal. To you and I, that is what break your back. To you and I, that is what is so painful. Having to receive forgiveness, that's the cheapest thing you can do. How many of you know that the moment when we are forgiven, we want to run? Ah, my dad, forgive me. So and so, forgive me. And so you can run. And so you can do this to a human. In fact, let me say this here to you. You can't do this to God. In fact, if you don't do this to God, you will not do this to another human too. We treat forgiveness so cheaply today until our relationships today has no values. You know how many people today come together to forgive one another? That's no value. There's no relationship. There's no in-depth relationship. There is no measure. There's no worth in those relationships that we call forgiveness. But when God forgives you, there's a moral commitment. There's a moral responsibility. He cannot forgive you in the person of His Son and yet not let you be like His Son. Because if you don't become like His Son, then what He forgave you for is futile. Yes or no? Forgiving you, forgiving me, but only to find out years later, we're no different than He first forgave us. We're still the same guy. You know how many people today are sitting in the church being forgiven by God? We're still the same guy. We're still the same man. We're still the same woman. We're still the same guy. We're still the same husband, same wife, same son, same daughter. And we call ourselves a forgiven man. And that is exactly what the psalmist understood here. He says, but there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared. God, you forgive me so that I will fear you. I don't want you to forgive me so that I will run away like a free slave and do what I want. God, you forgave me so that I may what? Fear you. I wish so many fathers who forgive their sons and daughters can come back to their father and say, Dad, thank you for forgiving me because now I fear you. When was the last time you ever heard prayers like that? Louis loving. You forgive them, they come back, they love bomb you some more. They hurt you some more. They disappoint you even more. God, you forgive me that I might fear you. See, this is centering. Guys, listen. This is schooling. This is being schooled in Jesus Christ. I don't want you to forgive me, God. I want that forgiveness to so work in me. It start to turn everything in me to be like you. That I might fear you. Remember what I said about the fear of the Lord? That I might honor you. That I might come to a place to live without you. To live not having you. I can't live without you. I got to honor you. You got to become first place in my life. You got to become the preeminence. You must be the preoccupation of everything that is in me. You must be the center of my life. You cannot forgive me and let me go run off to be somebody else. And when that is achieved, when that is learned in this man's life, any wonder, guys, that he can hope? He entered into a Christian hope, into a powerful hope of his worth revealed to him. This is a revelation, guys. I always say that hope is a revelation. As any Jewish people today, all through the 6 million Jews that were murdered by Adolf Hitler in Europe, every Jew today who have ever survived will tell you this. The only thing, if they ever survived, this is the only thing they said. We survived was because there was hope. He said, without hope, we would have perished. Hope is powerful. Hope keeps you alive. Hope keeps you going. Hope gives you meaning. Hope. And when a man has been centered in God, in the process of centering, God gives to him tremendous hope on the basis of his word. And when there is hope, that is what? That is waiting. So even as I shared this with you, this whole work here, this ministry has been tested on these grounds. I'm not sharing this just because it's Psalm 130. But I'm sharing this here with you because this is the story of Pure Stream. That's why we can't minus out the fact that this schooling, that this work has gone into the schooling, and part of the schooling has to be taught in all of us, not just myself, but all of those that are bound up with this work, what it means to walk through this, the emptying process, the removing of all of our trust and our own ability, so that in the centering that God brings us to himself, we begin to apply and understand this power of hope. And in the hope, we wait. That's why we're waiting. Just like what Eugene said, that, you know, he stands up here and approaches this work here, be it 20 or 200 or 2,000, is the same. And I want to say this here to you. If tonight there's 200 that pack this entire room here, it will not change a single atom of the way in which I shared this word. I would have preached, I would have taught as if this whole room is full of people. Or if you enlarge this hall to a 2,000 auditorium, it makes no difference. I would have wrote the same thing. I would have said the same thing. I would have brought the same intensity. Because that in itself is a test of where I am. It's a test of where any one of us is in. And that's why there is no shortage of God plunging our depths, not just in our personal life, even in the lives of this ministry, of God having to reach the depths of all of us. Our lives, our marriages, my own marriage, my son's life, our lives together. And this is what, that's why, guys, you see this now? Church is more than just a building. Church is more than just coming together and do handshakes and bear hugs and high fives. Church is this. Church is the conversation in which we carry on this kind of a content. When we come together in the future as a church, this is the content. This is where we need to meet eyeball to eyeball and to know that names like you all has got stories that comes from your depths. Why is it that we have to pass through all of this? I can sit down, I can step up here and tell you the whole night of the men and women that we saw where depths were reached, and many of us were scared stiff of our depths. And that's why we ran. We cave in. We just collapsed. We just bottom out. Depths were revealed. Depths were opened up. But God has to reach depths in the process of centering. How can he center you in himself and yet not show you who you are? Even the Father has to see the face of his own Son on the cross. If God has to see who is the Father, has to see the face of his own Son, how is it that you and I, who has been saved by him, he will not see your face? And why is seeing our face so unwelcomed, so uncomfortable, so unnerving is because when God sees our face, we start to see who we are. And we are not comfortable when we start to see who we are. And until God can reach our depths, don't be afraid. You guys in the center, a Thomas who corrects you, a Jeff Matthews who corrects you, oh, that's only the beginning. Let it be. Or a brother who corrects you, a sister who corrects you, a husband who corrects you, a wife who corrects you, a friend and a colleague who corrects you. It is only a glimpse of what God wants or begins in the process of the schooling. Amen. When He centered you into Himself. You like the word centering now? Center is wonderful. Someone said in physics, once you hold the center well, how many of you know that the circumference is good? Huh? It's like your bicycle wheel, isn't it? You need an axle, a center. Huh? So that all the spokes can hold the wheel properly. Can you imagine? You remove the center, you cycle, all the spoke will fly. You'll be a roda. Seeing it sebelah lah deh. You will have an accident. Holding the center is so that your circumference, your surrounding will be held in place. When God centers you, He will hold everything in place. The hope will hold you. Amen. Praise God. 10 minutes. Can we do this? Let's hear prayers here tonight. Come on, brothers.